the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about DigitalOcean, one of our incredible sponsors. They've got simple cloud hosting built for developers, and for all the code newbies who just started learning to code, yes, that means you, they've got one-click solutions for Rails, Django, Node, and much more, so you can launch your app in no time. And if you're looking for full control of your server, they've got that too. And if you use the promo code CODENEWBIE, you can get a $10 credit, so check them out and let me know what you think. Today, I am beyond excited to have Sandy Metz on the show. She asked me to describe herself as a person who's been programming for a really long time and accidentally wrote a book. Did I do that right, Sandy?
That's correct. That's exactly okay. Right.
So tell us a bit more about that. What is your background? Why am I so excited to have you on the show?
Well, I can't really explain why you're excited, but I can tell you that, you know, I'm a woman of a certain age. So unlike, the group of people who listen to Code Newbie are at the beginning of what will hopefully be an extremely long and happy career, and I'm at the opposite end of that arc. I sat at various places, went to work every day for almost 35 years and wrote code all day long every day. And at the end of that period, for reasons that maybe we don't need to go into, I ended up writing a book. And that dramatically changed my life. But I'm in my 50s. And so as we talked before we started, it wasn't really clear for me. It's not really clear to me how I should describe myself now. But I really do still think of myself as a programmer, right? I'm someone who writes code.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about how people talk of you and, about you, you're definitely seen as a programmer, an author, a teacher, a speaker, a mentor, a role model. You're kind of a lot of stuff to a lot of people. How do you feel about
that? Many of those
things
were somewhat accidental, I have to say.
Are you happy with those titles?
I've gotten used to them.
Okay.
Some of them, I am blue collar to my core. And I am a little leery of some of those titles. It doesn't mean they're not true. I'm going to do a slight sideways thing here.
Yeah.
You want to talk about imposter syndrome for a minute?
Let's do it.
Your code newbies may have a sense of that. I hate the term. I hate the term imposter syndrome, right?
Why?
It is accurate and very specific, and that's handy. It's good to have names for things. But we talk about imposter syndrome as if it's a thing where people are unwilling to believe how good they are, where they think they're fake, where they think they don't have a right, where they think they're not qualified. And so I think I have a little bit of like it's very easy to confuse honest humility with imposter syndrome. And I feel extremely confident in my abilities, extremely confident. Like without being a jerk, I feel like I can truthfully say, I feel like I'm a great teacher. Mm-hmm. I love that, right? I love teaching. I'm really good at it. And I'm perfectly willing to claim it. But at the same time, there's probably a million people who are better teachers than me. And so there's a bunch of, speaker, author, teacher. There's something about those role titles that seems a little grandiose to me, and I want to do them, and I work very hard at being good at them, and I think it's very cool to be able to have an effect on other people now at this stage of my life. But at the same time, I'm just a little leery about claiming those titles for myself in some way. I don't know. Does that make any sense at all?
It does. Does it make a difference that people give you the title versus you declaring it for yourself? Is there a distinction there?
Probably. One thing that's true, I think, is that when I wrote Practical Object Oriented Design in Ruby, when that book came out, it was the very positive response to it was completely unexpected to me, and I feel. I want to be very careful about being self-defined, being inner-defined, and not being outer-defined. And so I'm a little cautious about accepting, like, I love, it's really fun to have people say nice things about you. Don't get me wrong, right?
That
I
is
love
fun.
that. It is.
Yeah.
It's fun. And for me to do, especially talks, like I spend a lot of time prepping and doing talks in at open source conferences, and those they take in lots of effort, lots of time, enormous amounts of effort. And so really having people tell me that those talks are useful, it helps me feel motivated to do them. Because otherwise, right, that is a way in which I can give back to the community. But I just feel cautious. I feel cautious about buying into the Internet Sandy definition instead of me. But anyway, that feels like a whole tangent. Like, we don't really have to get in that. Yes, indeed, I am an author, and I am a teacher, and I am a speaker, and I'm careful about those roles. But not they're all really fun, but none of them are really as fun as writing code all day long every day. Gotta say that.
Amen.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the book a bit. Practical Object-Oriented Design in Ruby, which, as you described, changed your life. What was the inspiration behind the book?
Inspiration is far too strong a word. So this will be in this. I'm going to tell a little story here that will let this be a lesson to all your listeners. Be careful what you
Okay.
rant about. This is a lesson about the rant. I went to the very first Rails Conf in Chicago in whatever it was, 2005, 2006, I think 2005. And I had been writing code for a long time by then, right? And I had written a little bit of Rails code, not much. Rails was very new. And I had
Was Ruby new?
Ruby was not new. Ruby had been around, gosh. I used to know that date. Maybe 91 was the first real release of Ruby. I don't quote me on that. That could be wrong. But Ruby significantly predates Rails. And so Rails Conf came out, and I went to Rails Conf, and I did that thing that you do when you're new and you're at conferences with people where you don't know anybody. I did Wallflower, right? I stood around and watched other people talk to each other who seemed to know each other. But then I started going to talks, and I realized that there were a bunch of topics being talked about from stage that I felt like I maybe knew as much about as the speaker, or maybe
Oh, good for
even,
you.
yeah, didn't really even necessarily agree, which was a little bit of a surprise to me, right? Because you know how we are, you assume everybody knows what you do, like everybody else knows more about, like what you know seems obvious,
Yes.
and right? Like
Yes.
you know
Is
it,
there a
so
term for
clearly
that?
everyone does.
Yeah,
I
there
think
has
people
to
call
be.
that imposter syndrome, which it doesn't seem like that at all. It just seems like human nature, right? You know it therefore it must be apparent to the entire world. And so I was surprised to find that things I knew that I thought were apparent to everybody were not. And I would have little hallway rants to other people about, I wish they would have put it this way. Like here's what would here's the experience I would have. They're explaining something that seems very simple to me, and they're explaining it in a way that makes it impossible to understand. That would be my hallway rant. And I got overheard by someone who's an editor at Addison Wesley, and I didn't know it at the time. So I basically got caught in a hallway rant saying that explanation was far too complicated and it's about a really simple issue. They could have just said X. And so that incident started a campaign that took it, they started the this woman who became my editor at Addison Wesley started bugging me then to write a book, and it was 4 years before I finally accepted that perhaps I had a thing to say that would be useful
Wow.
to some people. Yeah, I didn't start we're actually working on the book till 2009. And so during that period, like I'm not one of those people that, wrote a decided they wanted to write a book and pitched, Prag Prog or somebody. I was pretty much led kicking and screaming.
I'll say 4 years, it sounds like it. So why the kicking and screaming?
I mean, she wouldn't take no for an answer. What's the biggest thing you've ever written? Tell me that. What's the largest thing you have ever written? How long would it be?
Maybe like 25, 30 pages.
So that, and when did you, what was that for? Was it school thing
Probably
or was
some
it
college
tech
paper.
thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, college
Probably
paper.
like
Well,
a
I was a,
college paper, high school paper. Yeah.
okay, I was a music student, so I didn't write any papers. The last time I wrote anything as long as, say, 10 pages was in high school. And that would be, 40 years ago. Like, I had no desire to do it. Now, I'm a big reader, And I'm picky, right, about other people's writing. But the thoughts of organizing an entire book, it was incomprehensible. It seemed impossible. Like, how would you do it?
So it was the issue of just the fact that it was a book.
It wasn't
the fact that it was your ideas or your name. It was just the idea of writing a book.
I mean, part of it was it just seemed impossible. Part of it was, what do you write about? I mean, they didn't tell me what was it going to go in that book. They didn't even really tell me what it ought to be about. Right? They asked me what I wanted to write about, and it took a long time. I gave a few talks during that interval, just a few, one in 2009 and then one in 2011 at both in New York, at GRUCO, actually, where, let me give them a shout out. I'm going up there next weekend for that conference. And so on the basis of those two talks, I mean, it was pretty clear that I would write about object-oriented design. That's what I'm interested in, right? But yeah, it was a pretty iffy, it was way too open-ended for someone that hadn't written anything longer than 10 pages for 40 years. I can tell you that. You know, and so the writing was very hard. The writing was absolutely torturous, and it took a long time for me to get the book put together.
How long was Pooter?
How long did it take me to write it?
How many pages was it?
I got one right here. I'll pick it up and look. It's hard to know. I think it's the perfect size. In print, it's 200, and the last page number is like 247.
That's definitely longer than 10 pages.
It is definitely longer than 10. But now it's paperback, so that's in the paperback size. I am very pleased with the size of Pooter, I have to say, because it's big enough to be worthwhile and small enough to make you look at it and give you the impression that you could actually read it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because tell me about your experience reading tech books.
I was going to say, actually, I see people, because I think the blog posts are just too common nowadays. So I've seen people put together ebooks, but the ebooks are like 25 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find that insulting. I'm like, there's no way. there's no way you're going to deep dive or give me anything really, you know, substantial in just 25 pages. So, but your length, I think, is the right length.
It is the right length. I mean, okay, I don't want to say that there's no short ebook that's worthwhile, but I mean, I can tell you, like we're at this weird transitional phase in the history of publishing right now where all of a sudden the means of production has been moved into my hands and your hands. And so anybody can write a book now, and there's a lot of ideas that maybe we're going to be grateful. That, you know, the barriers to entry were very high when you had to go get a New York publishing house to print your book. But now that you can go to LeanPub and write something down and say it, I mean, maybe we're going to find that some enormously valuable things come out in short form. However, my experience is also matches up with yours, that there's a fair amount of content being produced by individuals that seems to me to be more like blogs than books.
Yeah,
you say that.
It's content marketing. That's really what it is.
In the let's be generous-hearted about it, but I don't really want to spend $40 on a 25-page ebook that someone wrote over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I want more from them.
Right.
You know, and that's, you know, I'm in the process of writing another book now with Katrina Owen, someone that folks might know. She's the woman who started Exorcism, and I also teach with her some. And my experience, I'm definitely interested in self-publishing. I plan to self-publish. But it's also true that I've been absolutely ruined by the very high standards at Addison Wesley. So, you know, I've had to hunt down, we got art and we got editors. And, you know, it's going to feel more like a real print book. And it is just from coming out of that environment. And so when I read people's ebooks, if they haven't done those things, like if they're not professionally edited, it just makes me grumpy. I feel ill-treated by them, you know?
You feel disrespected.
It did. Well, yeah. In some real, I avoided that word, but yes, I would agree with it.
It's okay. I will say the words you can't say.
You say that. Worry. Say that for me. Thank you.
Yeah, we had Katrina Owen on episode 10, actually, and she's amazing. She's been incredibly supportive to a lot of people in our community. Tell us about the book that you are in the process of writing with her.
So she and I have been teaching. I have a course. Katrina sometimes co-teaches with me. She and I have, done some serious geeking out about the exercises in the course. You can imagine. Like imagine this. Imagine that your life went from continuous deadline pressure every day. Like this is my life now, right? I get to think very, very deeply about how to write code and how to explain to people how to write code. And how simple exercises can be used to teach deep, pervasive, powerful concepts. And so Katrina, as you know, knowing Katrina, you know that she is someone who will dive right in there with you if you want to have mm-hmm. that intensely nerdy discussion about code. Mm-hmm. And so we are taking one of the exercises from my course and expanding it to a full-length book.
Wow.
And I mean, here's the problem. When Practical Object Oriented Design and Ruby came out, Pooter, people wanted me to teach, and then so many people wanted, like, I have this wonderful problem that the course, I'm booked through the end of 2015 already. I'm not going to book another private course till 2016. And what that means is that, and mostly the private courses are behind the firewall. They are indeed private, right? So you have to work for some company that has enough money to bring me in to teach that course. And what that means, there's some weird thing, right, in which we are products of open source, and yet now I make a living in closed source.
Mm. Is that conflicting?
It is. It's a total conflict. And, you know, I like to think that my ability to travel and speak at open source conferences is, you have to say, financed by the private teaching I do. But at the same time, I've learned so much about how to write code in the last 2 years because I've had the leisure to think about it instead of running around like throwing code over the wall trying to get product out the door every minute. And I hate it that I don't have a good forum to get that information in very accessible ways out to everyone.
Mm. And so
that's what the book is. The book is the stuff we learned from teaching the course in a format that everybody can have, you know, even if they don't get to go. So it's, and there are, you know, we've been teaching over and we've taught it over and over again. And now that we're writing it, you know, there's something very scary about writing stuff down more so than making a talk. It feels so permanent. Like there's some weird way in which if you make a talk and there's a mistake on slide 47 and you say something stupid, it feels ephemeral. Like right? Talks feel transient in a way that books do not. Books feel permanent. And so it's taken us to a whole new level of thinking about what we mean and how to explain things. So the book, so here's the thing. This is the thing that, it's good I don't have much imposter syndrome. The book is going to be awesome. I'm so proud of it. It's taken forever as always because I'm a slow writer. It's primarily me, but there are ideas in this book that are going to change how people write code, and they're explained in ways that are absolutely sensible. Stuff about testing, stuff about refactoring, stuff about thinking about OO, stuff about understanding how to find concepts in complicated problems. You know, I want people like. Okay, here, I know I'm going on, and I'm going to say one more thing about this, and I'll stop. Okay. Well, you know that thing where people tell you about anything, and I'll use OO examples, but this problem occurs in all spheres of learning. There's a way in which often practitioners, people who are good at something, are actually terrible explaining it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And you can map this to any coding problem. For someone who's learning to code and they're trying to understand how arrays work or how hashes work or, you know, how to do looping or when you move into OO, which can be a little harder, like what's an object and what's a message and, you know, what should I put where? How should I do it? What you find is that some people will take the description of a problem, some experts who would take a description and they would say, well, obviously there's a, look in there, can't you see there's a chair object and a bowling object and a frame object and a, you know, beer object, whatever. But they can't, and as a kid, you look at the problem description and you look at the expert's explanation and you say, how did you know?
Mm.
And the experts basically tell them at that point, well, can't you just see it?
Which is so unhelpful.
Right? And this is, and they think of this as a teaching technique.
Oh, no.
Didn't you just, can't you just tell? And then when you can't tell, and the inference is that you're stupid if you don't know it already, right? You're stupid if you can't just tell. And the problem is that the experts have forgotten how they learned. Like, they were not born knowing the answers. They were not born with the ability to look at a problem description and understand how to write up the code, how to structure and code. What happened was, at some point, they were as baffled as the people, you know, newbies are today, and then they figured it out. They learned something which they have since forgotten. They've forgotten the transition points. And so Katrine and I spent, I did not want to go into the classroom and tell people, can't you just see? That did not seem like an effective teaching technique to me. And so what we did was we went and we figured out very simple, straightforward rules that you could apply that would let you, that would serve to let you teach yourself how to write code. So the rules are really understandable and they're very repeatable. Anyway, so there's that. Like, I believe that we have figured out a set of very simple, repeatable rules that we can give people that will let them teach themselves how to be the person that can look at a problem and see the objects. And that's what's going to be in this book.
And that book is 99 Bottles of OOP.
Yeah, right. That's the 99 Bottles of OOP book.
So when is that going to come out?
Well, okay. So I'm going to don't hold me to it. We have a very, very serious intent.
Yes.
To have, okay, the first enough useful content, which would be the first half,
okay,
in beta by the end of July.
Okay.
Because
that's pretty soon.
Yeah, it's pretty soon. So we have like a heads down 8 weeks coming up here, and we need that to happen. Like all of us, I need deadlines, and that deadline is the deadline that's keeping me from accepting like traveling engagements this summer. Because if I didn't have that deadline, I would just say yes when people ask me to do things, and then it would never get done. So we're going to have it. It will be available before I go to Barucco in the fall, before I go to whatever that is, Stacked Conference, Full Stack Conf in Barcelona in September.
Okay. So we should see it very soon. That's very exciting.
We should see it soon, yes.
Okay. And this is, are you self-publishing this or are you working with
another? We are going to self-publish this. There's some possibility that it'll get distributed through other channels later. That's all sort of under negotiation right now. But it will first be available directly from my website, from sandymetz.com. And it'll be, you know, out there on the end. It'll be easy to find once it is available for folks.
Yeah, and we'll have the sign-up link available on the website too.
Oh, that would be cool. Yes. I always forget that we can do that, but yes, let's put the sign up link on the website.
Yes.
Yeah. So it'll be there. There's a sign up link. That sign up goes to the 99 Bottles newsletter, which is very specific just to the book. There's also my own newsletter at sandymetz.com, which will at least tell people something's happening with 99 Bottles. You should go, you know, I'm not going to cross pollute those newsletters because I hate that when people do it, but
yeah,
there'll be notes in places that'll make the, you know, news and announcements will be obvious, I think, when it comes out.
You talked about how practitioners who are very good at something forget how they got there. So as someone who's been coding for many, many years, how did you not forget? Or did you have to kind of relearn how you learned?
I think there's about 10 answers to that question. I'm going to try to be focused. And actually, I'm going to write it down so I don't just wander off.
Yeah, take your time.
Okay. So
I feel like it's fun when you wander, though.
Well, I have to be a little careful because I like to close the loop instead of just going off
some point,
and receding into the distance. Yeah. I have some qualities that make it easier for me. So I'm like biologically hardwired in some ways. And one way, like if I take the Myers-Briggs test, I am almost always completely, you know, they'll give you, there's four different qualities and there's four different, I don't know, categories of things. And then you can be on one side or the other of every four of those categories. So if you were to go online and take a Myers-Briggs test for, do people know what that is? Should we?
Let's define it very quickly.
I'm going to have a hard time doing it. It's like a personality inventory scale, but it tells you sort of what kind of qualities you have along four different dimensions. I'm going to try to think of an example. And if you can think of there's a judging, sensing,
I'm about to look it up,
judging.
Actually.
Are you looking it up? Yeah, there's a scale with four different things. And the words are kind of weird because they're psychology words, so they don't always make practical sense. But basically what happens is there's four different dimensions. Each dimension has, you know, you can think of it as a continuum where you could be on one end of the continuum or the other or somewhere more near the middle. And knowing other people's Myers-Briggs scores gives you an explanation for how they behave or what their choices might be. So it gives you knowing this information about someone else lets you understand their point of view, where they're coming from, and you can sort of be maybe even predict how they'll react in certain situations. And, you know, certain Myers-Briggs types get along better with others Myers-Briggs types, right? So it's just a way to understand how they look at the world in an explanatory way.
Yeah, I was looking at the different scales, and there's like extroversion or introversion is one. Mm-hmm. Another one is sensing versus intuition. Another one is thinking or feeling, and then judging or perceiving. So if you combine, you know, these eight different things, you get a bunch of different Myers-Briggs type indicators, I guess, and personality types that do exactly what you said, tells you something about how the person looks at the world, makes decisions, what their preferences are, gives you some sense of their personality.
Yeah, and it's really nice, right? Because nothing is good or bad. There's no judgment here.
This is different.
It's just different. And knowing that and the introvert-extrovert one is one of the easiest ones to understand, right? Knowing that someone is an introvert, you can predict some things about them, but it's also, they're also explanatory, right? You might say, you know, Saran didn't come out tonight, and then you make an attribution about that. She doesn't like me, or she's had too much social interaction with people and she needs to recharge, right? And so knowing that makes it helps with the kinds of attributions you would make about people's behavior. Okay.
Are you, by the way? Are you
When I take the test, I am flat across all those scales. I'm almost exactly in the middle of every one of those things. I've taken it a number of times. And it's surprising. You don't really see that score very much. But what it means is there's a reason why I seem like the world. Here's how the world looks to me. From your point of view, you're probably right. Right?
That's so agreeable.
Right? Like, I think, yeah, well, I can see that. And so when I get in a situation, like I've spent my entire life in situations where two people were having a dispute. And I would listen to the dispute and then explain them to each other. Right? Yeah. Or I'll go to meetings where there'll be these big, I mean, I did it at Duke for many years. I would be, you know, I'm the tech nerd in there in jeans and a t-shirt. And there's a bunch of guys in suits, which is kind of how it works. And they would have this conversation where they were obviously did not understand. I mean, they just absolutely were not understanding one another. And I would end up getting up and drawing pictures on the whiteboard. So they could understand what each other was saying. Like they didn't appear to have the ability to understand that they did not understand each other.
Yeah.
And I found it so surprising. Like, to me, it was so obvious that each of them were saying different things and that each of them did not understand the other. And so that quality, I think, makes it. So combine that. Okay, now, so there's that. There's the Myers-Briggs. I'm flat on the Myers-Briggs scale. There's another thing called theory of mind. And I have a psych degree. And here's what theory of mind is. Theory of mind is, I have an idea of what you think. Right? I think you think. But then theory of mind gets worse, right? I think you think I think. Right? I think that you think that I think that this interview has gone well, right? That's a, you can do it, I do right? And you, exactly. Yeah. So I'm correct in my theory of mind.
Yes.
Right. And so some people seem to have a good theory of mind. Some people have a terrible theory of mind. They don't seem to be able to look at other people and form the correct theory about what's going on inside their head. And so it might be related to Myers-Briggs stuff, I can often look at people and tell whether or not they understand the explanation I'm giving them. And that has helped, because when I see people not understanding, I have learned just to stop and ask, uh-oh, seems to me like you don't understand. Tell me, talk to me about it. And so I have that. I have a good theory of mind. I think these are wiring things. I think these things are biologically. Like, my theory of mind is good. I'm even on the Myers-Briggs scale. The other thing that happened when I wrote Practical Object-Oriented Design in Ruby is I would first write code in the chapters. I would write code to explain something. So I'd write the code down, and then I would go write text to say in words what the code was doing. And then I would realize that there were huge leaps in the code. I would think that I had written the tiny little incremental steps from one code transition to the next, but instead of going from A to B to C, I'd really gone like from A to L. I mean, basically, yeah. There's this hand-wavy thing where a miracle occurs, right? It's that part where you're telling people who don't know it yet, oh, don't you just know this,
mm-hmm.
right? Don't you know, can't you see? And so once I had to start writing down the explanations of the transitions from one code sample to the other, it just became apparent that I'd left parts out the hard way. And then I had to go figure out what were those parts. Like, how did I know to go from A to L? What happened in the intervening gap? So some of it I'm hardwired to know, but some of it I had to rediscover. I had indeed forgotten how I learned, but it was obvious when I tried to write it down that it was woefully inadequate and that I should figure out what happened in those steps.
So I think it's interesting that you went from being an author and kind of a teacher by writing to having actual courses. And so when I was in undergrad, I was pre-med, and I actually taught organic chemistry for like 2 years while I was a student. And a lot EGAD. Of what I did was, what is it?
EGAD. I'm
what
saying
is EGAD?
Congratulations, organic chemistry. I've always wanted to take it, but I hear it's hard. That's all I'm saying. That was an admiring EGAD.
Okay, thank you. My husband is now laughing at me. That's fine. So it's one of those things where it's hard, but it's hard because no one tells you how to study for it and how to approach it. And I feel like, you know, the first exam I took, I failed at it terribly, and I had to really think about my process and analyze how I did things. Mm-hmm. And once I did, I kind of came up with my own little tool set, which I used to teach and helped a lot of people. But I realized that when I'm, you know, standing in front of the classroom and teaching with, you know, a chalkboard or, you know, a whiteboard, I find it a lot easier because I can see people's faces. I can mm-hmm. watch their reactions. Mm-hmm. I can say, you look very confused right now. Mm-hmm. What's on your mind? Mm-hmm. I can stop. I can pause. Mm-hmm. But when I went from that to having to, you know, at some point later on, write down the lessons, yeah. it felt very uncomfortable because I kept thinking, this sentence makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense? Are they still with me?
Yes.
How were you able to kind of know where the audience was when you're writing?
It would have been much easier. It was horrifying, and it was very hard, right? I mean, all I did was I just went through it over and over and over again, and I tried to make a tightly linked logical chain, and that involved a lot of backfilling. And it seems as if apparently I've succeeded, right? The book does make sense. I mean, I had a very clear audience in mind. And it was the me I used to be.
Mm. That's a good point, yeah.
And so I knew that it seemed unconscionable to leave her hanging with those gaps. But I totally agree. It would have been so much easier. Like, very often what happens is that people follow the course, the path that you just described. They teach a course, and then They teach it. And when they get it, when they finally figure out how they should be teaching it, they write it down. And that becomes the book. And I'm definitely going, well, I am following that path, right? Because the book is the book Katrina and I are writing now. That's post-course.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But it is also true that Pooter was written really in a vacuum. I couldn't get people to read it. Only a few people read it. And they read it pretty much under duress. They read it because they were close to me here in Durham and they just couldn't escape me. You know, they were too... I got them to agree to read chapters and then they kept having to see me and then they felt guilty and they would finally break down and read it.
What it's like to be friends with Sandy Metz.
Exactly. Torture. Yeah. Torture. That's what we're saying. It's like, don't make eye contact. I mean, so many people asked to read it when I was writing it, I kept a secret for a while when I was writing it because I wanted to be able to quit without feeling bad. Like yeah. That seemed like the inevitable outcome. I would work on it for a while and then abandon the project. When I finally realized that I would have to start telling people in public that I was actually writing a book, then they started asking me chapters. But I don't know that anybody who didn't live here in the town with me actually managed to read, or certainly no one read at all. A few people managed to read a few chapters. It's, you know, it's a busy world. I got so used to that idea that I would tell people when they asked me if they could read it, I would send it to them and I would say, you can still make eye contact with me later when you don't. Like, do not avoid me if you don't read it, because right. I don't want to lose you over this. I fully expect you to do nothing. You are not allowed to feel guilty if you don't go through this.
So how did it get from expecting people to not read it to being such an incredible and valuable and popular resource in the Ruby community?
Well, I don't know if I can explain that. I just did the best I could.
Yes.
And I hated every minute of writing it. I really did. there's a weird pleasure in finally getting a paragraph right or finally getting a sentence right. Or, let me look at the clock here so I don't go on and on about this. So here's how it worked. Here's how the writing worked for me, right? I would put a chapter, I would write the examples, and then I would write some English, and then I would realize I'd left half the examples out, and then I would go try to figure out what rule I could give people to let them get from A to B, C to D, E, so they could do it themselves later, which was what my goal was. And so then I would have a whole chapter. I'd have some idea that I thought went in that chapter. And then there would be a bunch of writing and code that all seemed defensibly well connected. And then there would be some page or two of apparently out of place stuff that didn't seem to fit. And I would get that far in a couple of weeks. It would take me a couple of weeks on every chapter to get that far of getting up every morning at like 5 o'clock and writing. And going to work it, you know, later. And then, so I'd get most of what seemed like all the content of a chapter ready, but I would have this wart, right? This clump in the middle that didn't really fit. And I knew that I did have excellent editors at Addison Wesley. I knew that Michael, my editor, would not allow that part that didn't fit. I knew there's no point sending it off to them because it's just going to come back in a sea of red ink. And so I would just, and then I would just, not know what to do. And I would get up every morning, I would just walk around and cuss. I will not cuss. I will not illustrate that for you, but I did. I would walk around and just bang my head on the wall and cuss and cuss and cuss and bang my head. And I would sleep and dream about it. It was a time when every morning I would wake up dreaming about the book day after day after day. And it took about 2 weeks. I eventually learned that every time I would go through this process and that it took 2 weeks at this point. So 2 weeks of being confused and cussing and banging my head and dreaming. And I would wake up and I would realize how that apparently unrelated part fit. And I would know that it was the most important idea and it was the thing that people needed to know. And I would understand how to link it into the rest of the chapter. And so that being willing to go through that over and over. So after a few chapters, it became clear to me that I signed up to write this book, and then I told people I was writing the book, and then I was going to be embarrassed if I quit. And I had to do that thing where you decide it's a heroic undertaking, and no one was reading it. No one would read it. And I was suffering like this every day. And I had to decide that I just, for my own feeling of human self-worth, I felt that I needed to finish. And not only did I need to finish, but I couldn't do a half-assed job. I had to do all the suffering. I just had to do every bit of it. Like, I had to make it as perfect as I could make it, even though it seemed like no one was ever going to read it, because I would never feel good about myself if I quit. And that ended up making the book that people read now. And it clearly was worthwhile. I mean, that's what we know today. It was very clearly worthwhile. I get tweets and email still 2.5 years later. I get 5 or 6 times a week, I get something from some stranger that says, that book changed my life. It's very cool, but it was not why I did it. I can say that. It was not why I did it. I had no idea that was going to happen. As a matter of fact, I firmly believed that no one was going to read it. All the evidence I had indicated that no one, it was not ever going to be a thing that people knew about. And so those are really distinct and unrelated events, right? The writing of the book and the popularity of the book are almost completely disconnected in my mind.
And I find that so, I don't know, almost comforting, right? Because I think that
it ought to be.
I like this idea that you did it because you wanted to do a good job, because you kind of told people you weren't really happy about the process, which is unfortunate, but also comforting. And then it
got easier.
Out.
I can reassure any aspiring author. I mean, I think I am particularly slow, but even I got faster, and so everybody isn't guaranteed to have as terrible an experience of writing as mine. I would tell you and anybody listening, if they ever thought they wanted to write a book or anything of any substantial length, that it's well worth it, even though I do make it sound like pure torture, which it also is. Right?
Yes. So Pooter is definitely a very popular book, and I'm wondering, when is the right time to read it? I think I read it maybe 8 months after I started coding, and I was, you know, pretty comfortable with like the Ruby syntax and all that, and was kind of figuring out how to use it, you know, to the best of my ability, and how to use it to write really good apps. But when is the right time?
I'll tell you 3 categories of people who read it and the experience that they have. First of all, I wrote it for the old me. And the me I had in mind was the me that had been writing object-oriented code for a year or two, so maybe slightly more experience than you had when you read it. I imagined that it would be useless to everyone else. I thought that if you had more experience, you would already know all these things, and if you had less, it would be something that you were not yet ready to understand. In the real world, So that group of people does indeed read it, and I think they were my original target audience. Let me say, when I wrote, that was the reader that I imagined. That was the explanations were scoped to the person with that level of experience. Three other categories of people have read it. One is a lot of people with far less experience have read it, and I found that astonishing. When people like kids in code schools started coming up to me and saying, where I'm at week 9 of code school and they're having us read your book. And I would say, really? Like, how's that going for you? Right? It didn't seem possible that it would be useful. And when I quizzed them very often, so then the conversation would then go like this. I would say, so what'd you think? And they would say, oh, I loved it. And then I would ask, how far did you get? And there's a big, you may not remember. I mean, I know this because I wrote it. There's a big the book is really basically in two big parts. And the first part is pretty concrete, and then there's this sort of dramatic increase in the level of abstraction in the second half. And so it's very common when I talk to people who don't have a lot of experience who tell me, actually, they're very happy about the book. They thank me. They tell me it was great. It really helped them. And then when I ask them how much they read, they usually stop somewhere in the middle. They get through chapter 4, and then they kind of bog down in chapter 5, and then they put it away. They put it under their pillow and hope that will work.
So, yeah, that's how I read it. I'm just saying.
And put it under my pillow. Probably. I think it's true that there's a time for the second half of it. I mean, it's not all that hard. It's worth looking at all the pages. But what I tell those folks now, the folks that don't have enough experience, I tell them, just read it if you want. Pick it up. Read it until you're not enjoying it, and then put it away. And you'll find someday you should come back to it. Like, come back in 6 months and look at it and see if that part seems more enjoyable. And so the real newbies are finding the first half useful, but they don't finish it. They do not get through it all. The other group, a second group of folks who've read it, that, and I find this very gratifying. This, it pleases me to no end to tell you that I talk to a lot of DevOps folks who read it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I came a little bit out of that background, that sort of, you know, operations, you know, going down that, back in the mainframe world, I did some of that. And I feel a very strong connection to that community. And I didn't think of them as folks who were writing straight up boot, but they're doing a lot of Chef and writing Ruby scripts. And they're finding the book really useful and reachable, approachable. And I it really does. That pleases me to no end. I love the DevOps crowd and the thought that I could do something that was useful to them was very pleasing. The third group of people that have read it are folks who know a lot about OO. And that's just been fun. You know, I occasionally get some, they are people who have some differences of opinion about the advice I give and who will sometimes push back or challenge me on some stuff, which is really fun. You know, it's very, very fun to talk to experts about those ideas. And in some ways, it's my, this is my card, my invitation into that world, right? The experts want to chat with me about OO because of stuff I said in the book, even if they have a difference of opinion. And so I've had some wonderful discussions with people who who I think of as mentors of mine based on things I said in the book. And that was a very unexpected pleasure, that there was any kind of audience at that level who would read it and find it interesting.
And that is part one of our two-part interview with the incredible Sandy Metz. It was so good, we're breaking it up into two pieces. And it was brought to you by DigitalOcean, one of our awesome sponsors. They're offering you a chance to try their cloud hosting service. If you use the promo code CODENEWBIE, you can get a $10 credit to get your app up and running. They've got easy one-click solutions for Rails, Django, and much more. And if you do try it out, please let me know. I'd love to hear what you think about it. Stay tuned next week for part two of the Sandy Metz interview, where we talk about speaking, conferences, and Sandy's experiences traveling around the world to teach and talk about code. Thanks for listening. See you next week.